I would like to ask you, what part does your faith play on your policy decisions?
First, my faith plays a big part in my life, and that's when I was answering that question, what I was really saying to the person was that I pray a lot. And I do. And my faith is very personal. I pray for strength. I pray for wisdom. I pray for our troops in harm's way. I pray for my family. I pray for my little girls. But I'm mindful in a free society that people can worship if they want to or not. You're equally an American if you choose to worship an Almighty and if you choose not to. If you're a Christian, you're a Muslim, you're equally an American. That's the great thing about America, is the right to worship the way you see fit. Prayer and religion sustain me. I receive calmness in the storms of the presidency. I love the fact that people pray for me and my family all around the country. Somebody asked me one time, well, how do you know? I said, I just feel it.
Shut the hell up, Boy George. This nonsense about I receive calmness in the storm. Of course you do, because in the storm of war, a draft-dodging coward like yourself runs and hide underneath the skirt of his own father. And then you babble out, prayer and religion sustains me. Well, the slaves on revolt will vanquish you and your kind, and we'll make sure that's permanently sustained. And then you babble out of, you're equally an American if you choose to believe in an almighty or not. But you're not equal if you're black. You're not equal if you're Latin or Asian or Arab. You're not equal if you're an Indian or a woman. You're not equal if you're homeless or poor or a kid. You're not equal if you do not have health care. You're not equal if you live in a polluted community. So not all is not equal on Sam's plantation. That's what we're here for, to equalize it out. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check it out. You're listening to 104.1, 106.7, Illinois, Free Radio, Santa Cruz, LUBER.com, the world, and radioforall.net, the universe, slave of old time. Tonight, we're going to shoot our way into a Beyond the Shadow segment and deal with guns, God, and imperialism. Boy George's role in the hocus pocus world. And then we may slip into a few notes from a Draptomania. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1. Slave. Revolt.
A few days ago, it was suggested by some of us, as forcefully as we knew how, that in order for the country to be unable to ignore and to forget the slaughter of 6 children in an American city and in order to join the issue and bring the battle to where the battle really is, that is to say, to strike at the economic structure that no one, black or white, should buy any presents for Christmas. I think that we should spell this out perhaps a little more precisely. I mean, and now I'm speaking for myself, that in this Christian nation, Christmas is mainly, as indeed are most churches, a commercial endeavor, having nothing whatever to do with the birth or the death of Christ. That if one begins to serve notice, ultimately on the banks, that we, the citizens of this country, do not consider that we have the right to celebrate Christmas this year, and that furthermore, we will use every weapon in our power to force this on the attention of the American Republic, which unluckily, I have to say, has its conscience mainly in its pocketbook. I believe that we will begin to see some notion of our potential power. Let me put it this way. Before this country was established, when the country was being established, and this, apart from what one's textbooks say, and in contradistinction to the television myths about the building, the discovery of America, the people who came to America, as it turns out, were neither heroes, saints, nor pilgrims. They were simply people who couldn't make it where they were. And that is why they came. They came here to make, as we like to say, a better life for themselves and their children. And as it turned out, and as it always does indeed turn out, what they meant by a better life for themselves and their children was the opportunity to make more money and oppress somebody else. Which is what they did. The Indians had vanished, except for those we have under protective custody. And in order to build the country, it was necessary to find a source of cheap labor. And therefore, 400 years later, I represent the only man who never wanted to come here. But if I had not come under the double coercion of the Bible and the gun, I very much doubt that we would have all those railroads, and cotton would never have become king, and in short, the American economy would be at best a very different matter.
Everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You know what time it is now? Beyond the Shadow. And tonight, what we're going to deal with in part is this guns, gods, and imperialism. Killing in the name of, basically. You know, when a population is demoralized, gumpified down, and is on a political trajectory that is so far removed from any kind of eco-humanistic economic equality-based foundation, just like the rulers want. The ruling class historically and currently becomes more fervent in trying to push its population into this hocus-pocus fanaticism and illusory game. And often what you see within these societies is that much of that population becomes an assessor to the imperial expansionistic policies that are often coded in hocus pocus layerings, religious layerings, is basically what I'm saying. And that way, often things are justified within the smoke and within the shadow of being something that is decent and morally based. And some of the most obscene events in the world have been carried out through some of these marriages. And in part and parcel by those rulers within the Abrahamic religious traditions, the Christians, Hebrons, Islams. Now, recently there's been a new video out. It's called Bush, G.W. Bush, Faith in the White House. And we're going to explore what some of this quote-unquote faith really means beyond the shadow style, and shine some light on where those rulers in the cloud of all the mysticisms really want to, and historically have wanted to take things. So first, let's hear how this is being outlined within the whole context from an excerpt from Faith in the White House, and where these people have been taking a lot of this type of stuff. So check this out.
Regardless of the political outcome, there have been a great many changes at the White House. The president encourages Bible studies with prayer and unabashedly references God in his public pronouncements. According to Newsweek magazine, quote, "This presidency is the most resolutely faith-based in modern times. An enterprise founded, supported, and guided by trust in the temporal and spiritual power of God." And BBC correspondent Justin Webb reported that nobody in government spends more time on his knees than George W. Bush. The Bush administration hums to the sound of prayer. Prayer meetings take place day and night. It's not uncommon to see White House functionaries hurrying down corridors carrying Bibles. His example has brought about a national phenomenon called the Presidential Prayer Team. The person responsible for that is Megan Gillen, the Director of Communications.
The Presidential Prayer Team is a nationwide initiative whose sole goal it is to stimulate prayer for the President, his Cabinet, and other key leaders on his team. It exists in perpetuity to support in prayer whoever occupies the Oval Office. In addition, we call our members to prayer or the members of our military who serve around the world, particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan. It spread like wildfire across the nation, and before we knew it, we had 5,000, 10,000, some days as many as 28,000 people joining this effort to pray for the president. Today, we're happy to say we have over 3 million participating, and some weeks we have over 10 million hits on our website, all people inquiring about prayer. Prayer meetings and Bible reading sessions were and are still conducted in the various departments of government. They're not mandatory, but they're not held in secret either.
So right there you get a flavor of what the hell's going on. This is like some medieval stuff. Clowns running down the hallways with prayer books and all of that. And this often, amongst other things, helps cloak the true intentions and policies of people within the ruling circle and who are servants to the ruling circle. If you get caught up in analyzing these people on some kind of false moral pretense, you know, in other words, it becomes a thing of, do they bend their knees to the same invisible man that you do? And if they happen to do that, then that gives them some kind of special moral plugs, stars by their name. You can, in a gumpified society and droned out world that we live in, this often comforts those who don't have any food in their stomach, may not have any health care, can't get a job where they can work full time, and if they do get a job that's full time, they're asked to slave for like 65 hours a week. Yet all that often disappears in the mystical mindset of many people if they feel comfortable that the person who is helping administer the charge against their class interests believes in the same invisible man that they do. And often, many of these clowns will support these particular policies from various governments. Israeli governments, in the case of a lot of Hebrews, Islamic governments, in the case of, you know, like the Sudan, you know, the Christopher Columbuses with turbans on over in the Sudan, and this wretched government right here, Sam's Land. I mean, this is a scam, you know. So, see how they got the game going. Boy George and them encourage presidential prayer teams. He encourages people to pray for him. He has thousands of clowns praying for him, millions coming up on the website, not looking at the class interest of things, not looking at are the policies that he is implementing with his compadres devastating the world's population and the ecosystem that we live in. So all this rhetoric, though, ends up coming down to no one spends more time on his knees than Boy George. This is just a fantasy game that they're playing. It's a smoke and mirrors game, but this doesn't come out of nowhere. It serves a particular interest. When a society and a government is being stripped more and more naked to cloak itself in hocus pocusisms, so you'll see an invisible halo around their head and an invisible cloth of, you know, a purity covering their bodies, is the way they want you to look at them, as opposed to seeing them for the pro-WTO, pro-World Bank, pro-structural adjustments, pro-imperialist wars, pro cluster bomb dropping, pro devastation to the environment through depleted uranium, pro sanctioning out defenseless society and causing a million people within a 10 to 12 year span to evaporate, a regime that it really is. Now, next, Esther Kaplan. She's the author of the book, With God on Their Side, describes how the hocus pocus phenomenon has played a role in influencing a top-down type order of politics. Let's check out what she means, and then we'll take it from there. Dig this.
Up until the war on terror and his morning terror briefings slightly disrupted the schedule, John Ashcroft, for example, had daily prayer meetings in the Department of Justice. They were in his office. He led them. So you can see how a young, ambitious person in the Department of Justice, this would be really an invaluable chance to get some face time with the boss. So part of the concern is not just that some government employees on their break, you know, want to pray. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. It's being organized by the top people in the White House, by the top guy in justice. And so it becomes this place where Christians who want to participate in this prayer have special access. Arguably had a chance to advance their connections, their career, their power base within whatever department it is by participating in these prayer circles. So there's a real question. And I think particularly coming from the person, the top law enforcement official in this country, John Ashcroft, for him to be muddying that line between government service and prayer is tricky. I want to just make a quick comment about that bit that you played from George Bush in the debates. I came across a column just, I guess it was from 2 days ago, that Paul Weyrich, who was one of the founders of the Christian right, he's the guy who came to Jerry Falwell and said, let's found a moral majority in America. He kind of knitted together this movement. He's considered the father of the movement. In a column on a right-wing website, he actually claims credit for the fact that that question was asked by Bob Schaefer in the debate. He says he wrote to Bob Schaefer, asked him to ask the president about his faith, and as he says, to my shock and surprise, Bob Schaefer did ask the question, and I was delighted with President Bush's reply. So even a moment like that, there's a careful coordination with Christian right leadership.
All right, so once again, you can see how the mechanisms of, consolidating a certain element of hierarchical conformist power can take place under these types of parameters. And at the same time, they are able to hide themselves, you know, people like Ashcroft, you know, Mr. Patriot Act himself is able to hide his horns in the shadows in the midst of all of that, thereby also set up a form of undemocratic elements of practices because of the kind of hierarchical slash lobbying sense. This case is some kind of mystical lobbying base type thing. So if you're some a peon trying to weave your way into the mechanisms of power, you know, administrative power for the ruling class, you have to don on the hat, in the case of America, of, you know, some kind of Christian fanatic almost. And this is all part of a conforming mechanism. So this is just another way of breaking people down into being drones and servants to the empire. In the same way as, you know, like I've mentioned before, you know, like about the Sudan, you know, after the NIF under Bashir took power in 89 when they did a little coup, and that thereby broke off any kind of basically peace negotiations that were then in the works with the South, and thrust the country into the next 20 plus years of civil war and chaos. When Bashir and his little militaristic coup government with the NIF took power, they openly were talking about they wanted an Islamic state, you know, Sharia law, the whole, you know, full Monty. And they call secularists atheists and anti-Islam. They, of course, then declared a state of emergency, suspended the Constitution. In other words, this is basically a third world country, so you got to be a little bit more raw. But you can see the same elements that are taking place in a more quote-unquote modernized country, where they have more flexibility to control people. So in the third world, when these little hocus-pocus Abrianic types want to do their little housekeeping and demonology and crushing of people's real souls, they do all of these particular mechanisms. So they in the case of Sudan, Bashir and them, the same ones that are, you know, now fighting in the western part of the Sudan, the black population there, even though they're Muslims and stuff, but they're also pro-expansionist imperialists. You know, they have this whole Arab identity / Islamic identity, the way much of the Christian white right has much of a white Anglo-Saxon Christian identity. So what you then see in the Sudan, though, what they did was they, after they came to power, they abolished the electoral system. They had anti-NIF, National Islamic Front, students beat down physically, you know, on the campus and stuff. They basically knocked off professors who weren't in alignment with their little religious hierarchy setup. And they imprisoned political opponents. They fired 20,000 governmental employees, etc., etc., university teachers, workers. So, and they were replaced by National Islamic Front members and supporters. So, as I said, in these more poor, because Sudan is dirt poor, one of the poorest nations in the world, even though it has one of the largest land mass in Africa and incredible amounts of resources and fertile land, yet because of their expansionistic, imperialistic, you know, ethnic cleansing type of philosophy, all under the cloak of another Abrianic form of hocus-pocusism, Islam in this case, the country's just thrown into a particular chaos. This is a first world nation, and you can see the type of chaos that is happening to at least many parts of society, the school systems, the healthcare system, so on and so forth. Now, if you magnify that same type of mindset and mentality amongst a ruling elite clique over into the Sudan, well, guess what? The ramifications are basically genocide. 2 million people dead in a 20-year period. You know, civil war and chaos, madness going on now in the western part. Nuba Mountains exploding and stuff, and on and on. Then you cross the lake and head on over to Israel. And you see another Abrahamic tradition, and they're cloaking their justification of domination of another people under the whole hocus pocus world, their whole hocus pocus worldview, you know, this kind of chosen people, you know, Zionist mindset. So the Palestinians in this case, bear the brunt, and are the ones who are ostracized and scapegoated and beat down and crushed day after day. And often many of the analysis that should be crystal clear about the policies of the Zionist government of Israel and the Zionist government of the Sudan and the Zionist government of Sam, you know, the three stooges, you know, Islam, Christian, and Hebron, is somehow missed because by many, because they have this kind of mystical belief in the so-called higher order of spirituality that these people hold because they claim or do bend their knees to, you know, these various invisible men in the sky. Since they're all part of the Abrahamic tradition, it's basically the same men. But, you know, that's a whole nother story, you know, with Akhenaten and all that. But next, let's move on to Bob Schiffer. He's the CBS News anchor. And he asked Boy George, his higher authority consolation, who the person who just spoke before, you know, Esther Raplin, was talking about how this basically this question got asked. So let's hear Boy George's response in full. You know, I blew him up right when he was getting into some of it, couldn't take it anymore, but let's hear more of what this fool has to babble out, and we'll take it from there. Check this.
You were asked before the invasion or after the invasion of Iraq, if you checked with your dad, and I believe, I don't remember the quote exactly, but I believe you said you had checked with a higher authority. I would like to ask you, what part does your faith play on your policy decision?
Of course, my faith plays a big part in my life, and that's when I was answering that question, what I was really saying to the person was that I pray a lot. And I did. And my faith is a very, very personal. I pray for strength, I pray for wisdom, I pray for a truth in harm's way, I pray for my family, I pray for my little girls. But I'm mindful in a free society that people can worship if they want to or not. You're equally an American if you choose to worship an Almighty and you choose not to. You're a Christian, you're a Muslim, you're equally an American. That's the great thing about America, is the right to worship the way you see fit. Prayer and religion sustain me. I receive calmness in the storms of the presidency. I love the fact that people pray for me and my family all around the country. Somebody asked me one time, well, how do you know? I said, I just feel it. Religion is an important part. I never want to impose my religion on anybody else. But when I make decisions, I stand on principle. And the principles are derived from who I am. I believe we ought to love our neighbor like we love ourselves. That's manifested in public policy through the faith-based initiative where we've unleashed the armies of compassion to help heal people who hurt. I believe that God wants everybody to be free. That's what I believe. And that's one part of my foreign policy. Afghanistan. I believe that the freedom there is a gift from the Almighty. And I can't tell you how encouraged I am to see freedom on the march. And so my principles that I make decisions on are a part of me, and religion is a part of me.
All right, so you see how Boy George is mixing straight up politics. And I hold on to that whole concept of what he was actually saying and how he actually approaches it to stuff that comes up later. But how he's mixing politics with religion and mixing it with quote-unquote freedom in Afghanistan. So he's giving it the veil of a guiding principle of a nation and a people who are on a higher moral authority level. Thereby, for many drones in the world who are gumpified down, that's enough. That's enough for them to hear. Not to get into the real policies, politics of Afghanistan, the history, how it was manipulated by former administrators to the empire, starting with in recent history with Carter's administration, when they wanted to basically give the Soviets their own Vietnam, as Brzezinski said, and help formulate this Mujahideen together with the ISI, which is the Pakistani intelligence agency, and how that became a fester for creating another batch of Frankenstein monsters, you know, the same way they've created other, you know, Frankenstein monsters throughout the world, you know, Saddam, Mobutu, Savimbi, and on and on. Immanuel Constance, who's now kicking it, living in New York, etc., etc. In essence, what I'm saying is that there are real policies and actions that this empire and its School of the Americas Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein Laboratory have done that have helped put this world and region in its very vulnerable state. But if some clown like a Boy George has a good portion of the population that all they need to know is that he feels he has some invisible man by his side to help ride the wave of justice over the skies on his little unicorn, then basically he has you and the empire and the rulers within the society have you where they want. So, of course, once again, we're in a more industrialized society. And it has a little bit more flexibility. So, of course, a Boy George can say, you know, in America, you can be, you know, Christian and Islam or Hebron, you know, do your little prayers, have your little mats, your little mosque, your synagogues, your churches, your crack houses, your, you know, McDonald's stores, you know, they're all basically the same, you know, fast food crack houses, fast food crack house liquor stores, crack houses, and crack house hocus pocus institutions. You end up in the same place. Delusional. But, of course, you can do all of that within this particular society with a certain amount of flexibility. Of course, they're always going to persecute the undesirables, you know, to allow their super rabble and to allow the tension within the working class to keep permeated, you know, keep the divide and conquer situation going on. Once again, of course, in the more impoverished countries and stuff, where they basically use these same type of hocus-pocus mechanisms, basically expulsionism and various things like that are generally the rule of thumb, especially nowadays. If you look at many places in the Middle East, you know, like Christians in the Palestinian territories have dropped from 15% of the Arab population in 1950 to 2%. And you can go on down the line in various so-called hocus-pocus holy lands, you know, where these guys, you know, Jesus, Moses, you know, and all that type of stuff. You'll see a lot of Christian, quote-unquote, exodus from these regions in the Middle East. And a good portion of it, 2 million fleeing in the past 20 years alone. The Iraqi Christians have been immigrating for years now, and it's not just because of the sanctions and stuff like that, because all people, you know, if they can in Iraq, are trying to get the hell out and have been trying to get the hell out. But it has been because of some of the other stuff that is often not reported that much because of the barbaric imperialist action that Sam is doing. You know, many of their stores, liquor stores and stuff like that, where Christians sell alcohol, are being bombed up and, you know, and all of that type of stuff. You have a situation was kind of ironic, because often there's many Muslims in the inner city who sell the same liquor, but that's another story altogether. Hypocrisy and religion go hand in hand, but I think that's been clear for some time now. But what I'm saying is that Boy George being able to say that they are more tolerant of, you know, who you bend your knees to is really irrelevant, because in part, what they really want to know is that, do you bend your knees down to the ruling class? And quite often, if you accept certain types of hierarchical structures, you know, the golden word of, you know, some invisible man, you're usually more prone to believe in the golden word of another type of father figure in the first place. So they got you either way. But from Lebanon to Egypt, we've seen, the declining Christian populations, and often is connected with the attacks and the intolerances and the policies that have been passed by a lot of these regimes over there in the Middle East that are unfair to the Coptics and Egypt and so on and so forth, you know, giving special privileges to the Muslim population and disenfranchising the Christian friend. It's just a divide and conquer game, but many people who would look at that, who are of one or another hocus pocus faith, who would usually be more critical of those types of things going down, you know, often because they're trapped within that hocus pocus world, don't take the same type of critical view. But next, let's go to Reverend Gaddy here. He was part of the Interfaith Alliance who sent Bob Schiffer that letter that he co-signed with the founder of the religious right, to hopefully get Schiffer to ask Boy George the hocus pocus question, and get George to go on and on about his quote unquote faith. So let's see what this Rev has to say. Check this out.
We actually are trying to preserve the power and the influence and the sanctity of religions in the nation, and maintain a situation that we are blessed to have with a constitution that makes it possible for people with dramatically religious differences to get along without the kind of competition and violence and bloodshed that we see in other places. The Interfaith Alliance is by no means interested in withdrawing religious influence from the public square. We are very concerned when political authority and religious authority are confused. Because when that happens, usually, historically, and Dr. Kazin could talk about this more elaborately than I can, when there's been that confusion of religious authority and political authority, both government and religion have been the losers, as well as those in the states where that happened. We think, and this was dramatically illustrated in the last debate. Interestingly, Paul Weyrich, founder of the Religious Right, and I co-signed a letter to Bob Schieffer asking him to ask a question about the role of religion in the candidates' lives and campaigns. The question was not about religion's influence generally, but the question that's been discussed from this program, how will your religion impact your political decision-making in both domestic and foreign policy? The American people have a right to know whether or not a candidate is making decisions on policies related to the Middle East on the basis of a literalistic reading of Christian apocalyptic scriptures, or whether on the basis of National Security Council recommendations on what's in the best interest of this nation. Dr. Donahue mentioned the potential dangers that come when values are used to justify actions that in some instances contradict the values that they claim motivate them. That's what the Interfaith Alliance is interested in.
All right, now, you know, when people talk all these various things about what their alliances are supposed to mean and so on and so forth, and what they want to know from a particular president about his faith and all of that, you know, this, you know, when you see people who are connected with the various religious right and all of that, and they talk about how they want a separation from the political aspect and the religious aspect. Often, when you hear these types of people say that, you just got to pull out your 45. Because many of them are the same people, especially some of these co-founders of the religious right, have been the advocates of the religious-based schools. And that, of course, is blurring the line intentionally. So they set up these schools that get taxpayer money. It's draining them from public schools. It's helping disintegrate the public school system. They have their own hocus-pocus sanctioned books and teachings and teachers and principles and guidelines, yet is coming out of the pocketbook of the taxpayers in the same way that these cruise missiles are coming out of the pocketbooks of the taxpayers and don't have the overall working class people's interest at heart. This is just a mechanism of groups within a particular sphere to siphon off in, money and autonomy from the masses of people and push the masses of people into the mold that they feel fit for their own particular overall benefit and aspirations and stuff. So when these guys get all into these hoodwinking words, you know, hiding in the shadow about what their intentions are, without just getting down to basically examining and attacking and critiquing what has Boy George and what have the policies that Boy George stood for. because it's clear on this hocus pocus level. He's been backing all of this stuff concerning creationism, you know, versus evolution. And it's had ramifications, not just in the concept of, you know, this invisible man make the world in 6 days and kick it back and rest on the seventh day, but the whole overall philosophy and science, hard science of evolutionary biology, which goes beyond just human evolution, but it goes into the whole science and biology of evolution, which is irrefutable, at least for those who have their eyes open or their intentions in the right place. But now, to show how all of this stuff does play into a more political role, regardless of what these guys try to hide within the shadow, here on Neil Cohen's Talk of the Nation, an NPR show, is a teacher from Texas, Laura Williams, and she goes in to the religious-based conformist philosophy about marriage and sex and other things. So let's see what this Williams has to say. And we'll take it from there. Check this out.
An editorial in a Texas newspaper this summer pointed out that 15 to 17-year-old girls in Texas have the nation's highest pregnancy rate. And though marriage is described as a lifelong commitment in these new textbooks, the divorce rate in Texas is still rather high. Do you anticipate any difficulty explaining the contradiction to students?
I don't, because I feel like part of that may be the education that a lot of girls and, you know, young people don't receive as far as how important it is for abstinence. I think a lot of times kids are said, well, if you use a certain kind of contraception that you won't get pregnant. Well, that's not true, you know. So I think, you know, the only way to definitely prevent an unwanted pregnancy is abstinence.
Mm-hmm. So as a teacher and a mother are too, are there other areas where you feel religious values or family values that should be reflected in the curriculum?
Well, I think that's one thing we've also tried to address in our district as well is things like honesty, trustworthiness. You know, that's things that, you know, school districts teach is, you know, and we're helping the parents. We're complimenting one another by teaching our kids, you know, family values and honesty and other things like that that would that are important for all of us to have.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you look back on this process, who ended up having the biggest voice in deciding what got put into the textbook?
I'm not sure what.
Was it the members of the boards of education? Was it parents? Was it teachers? What was it? The textbook editors and publishers.
The editors and publishers, you know, sat down.
They wrote the textbook.
They wrote the textbook, obviously, but a lot of the teaks or the things that we teach were addressed in that. And one of the teaks say the things that we teach, the skills that the kids need to have when they finish the classes that they take, would say abstinence is, you know, one of the areas that we teach. I mean, that's what our teaks say at this point.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, you know, besides her being an obvious gump, and this is a teacher now, but a Christian teacher. A lot of the stuff she was saying helps expose in some ways how they are basically set in a particular mold, and with the help of Neil Cohen, who wasn't obviously challenging some of the stuff that she was saying, have a preordained agenda that's not based off of any facts. So, like, in part, when the thing about teen pregnancy came up, and she was saying that part of, he mentioned the high teen pregnancy in Texas and stuff like that. She said part of it may be the fact that teens are not getting the info on abstinence. And said that they may be told to use other forms of birth control, like condoms, if you don't want to get pregnant. And that's, you know, not the the case. You could still get pregnant by other means. And the only way not to get pregnant is abstinence. Well, she didn't have any information where she broke down saying, look, we've asked the teen moms who have gotten pregnant, had they heard about abstinence? Was it discussed in school? Was it discussed amongst your parents? Did you just decide not to do it? In other words, there's nothing verifiable that could have been. I mean, they have lists of these, you know, teens who have kids and stuff. And if they wanted to go out and systematically determine why are teens in Texas getting pregnant, they could. They could find out the percentage of whom use birth control wrong, you know, put the had a condom break, decided just to go for it, wanted to get pregnant, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. Those who knew about abstinence or have been taught about abstinence from parents, loved ones, within the school system, et cetera, you know, went to a clinic and, you know, got advice about it and whatever route. But see, they don't want to do that. They're not interested in that. Because that would help bring down the hard facts that would help clarify this. They want to leave things in this kind of mystical thing where she can say, well, maybe and probably, you know, and just blame it on some, you know, other entity for why teens are getting pregnant, and then thereby have a quote-unquote legitimate claim to usher in this is the only way students should be taught abstinence. They shouldn't be taught any other method of birth control, etc., etc., and then cloak it around family values and things of that particular nature. See, this shows you how deceitful this whole policy of using religion and stuff like that. The fools just can't be honest quite often. And now they're trying to turn the religious-based policies that they're trying to implement into schools and other regions into other Orwellian words, family values. But if you use a term like family values, you're talking about a consensus on a value system. Now, what consensus is that volume system coming from? Because many people can say and talk about the family values, the high moral family values of America in the 40s. But those same high family values of the white families in the 40s were the same ones that had implemented and were maintaining the Jim Crow laws that were justifying the bombing and lynchings of black people, that were making lynch postcards of the black corpses that they burned, that were crushing black corpses into pieces, putting them into jars and selling them at dime stores like some kind of sick, macabre nightmare type thing. These are family values. This is the world of family values you're talking about? No, once again, this is the same type of hierarchical order that wants to maintain power, that justify the enslavement of black and the crucifixion of the Native American population. They can hocus pocus it any way they want, but if at the end of the day you're stealing land from Mexico, you're just another thief. Family values, words or not. So when Cohen did ask her a simple question about who decided what goes into the text, she's, you know, all flustered, like, you know, I'm not sure what you're talking about. What the hell are you talking about? I mean, how can you not? How could you not know? You know, and that's not a confusing question. Just answer the damn question straight up. It's like if they don't have some way to cloak it in mysticism, they're not sure how to respond to this same type of mystic construct about how one should use these types of hocus-pocus traditions for our own salvation. Here's Cornel West as he outlines how he feels there needs to be a rebirth of progressive Christianity for the salvation of the country. So let's see what West has to say about this and how he's playing into this whole mysticism game. Check this out.
And I look back, I say, let's look at our tradition. Walter Rauschenbusch, right down the street here, Hell's Kitchen. On the social gospel. Dorothy Day, the Catholic movement. Prophetic Christians have played a fundamental role in expanding American democracy. Where are they now? We need them badly. Jim Ford, Riverside Church, Wallace, and Sojourners, in Washington, D.C. Why is it that one could be on the workplace and say, you know, I'm not really crazy about George Bush, but he's a Christian, I'm a Christian, I'm a vote for him. The very invoking of the term Christian as a noun or an adjective sends chills down the spine of progressive, because it tends to be associated so quickly with the right. The 1960s, when Martin King was the major figure, he talked about Christian. Even some of the hippies flying high in the friendly sky would say, yeah, some of them are friends of mine. Like Martin and Fannie Lou Hamer and a host of others. Without the reinvigoration of prophetic Christianity, there can be no reinvigoration of American democracy. It's a major. Not sufficient condition, it's a necessary condition. It's part of the ideological and cultural war that must be fought.
All right, so, you know, West goes into, you know, how, you know, where are the, you know, prophetic Christian figures of the past, as, you know, basically what he's trying to do is saying that their Christian faith was a basis for their type of quote-unquote visionary outlook. But then he sums it up after going into how some drones, he admits, says that, you know, boy George is a Christian, I'm a Christian, so I'm a vote for him. But then he himself and despises that. But then he sums it up that without their reinvigoration of prophetic Christianity, there could not be a return to democracy in America. Now, I don't know what return this clown's talking about, but he's basically doing the same type of drone type of talk that he denounced the other drone who says he's going to vote for Boy George because Boy George is a Christian. Now, what West wants is people to have this kind of higher belief in some kind of Martin Luther King type of Christian, you know, figure to come around, and mixes it with that is the essence of our salvation in this country, not the masses of people defending physically, psychologically, and every other way you can imagine, their own well-being and their own rights for self-determination, and link it with sisters and brothers throughout the world for a common cause and agenda that is beyond the sphere and the shadows of an empire that wants to globalize, privatize, and isolate every form of living and non-living thing into some kind of prepackaged commodity that has a price tag stuck to it. In the real world, we don't need prophetic Christianity or any other form of Christianity to lead us to any form of salvation. If you truly believe in humanity as a whole, but if you're yourself locked into this form of mysticism, you're going to, in essence, basically play the same game that you're bewildered about the Christian right being successfully playing into. Because at the end of the day, you and them, in the case of West, may have more in common overall than one might think. But next, let's go back to the teacher from Texas, you know, the Laura Williams, who was on the NPR Talk of the Nation. And let's go into her being questioned by a caller on the evolution versus creationism question. And let's see how she deals with it and tie this all together from there. Check it out.
Let's hear from Mary, who's with us from New London, New Hampshire.
What's going on in Pennsylvania and Georgia, and I just have to say, and I have to say that I'm really very spiritually and religiously inclined as well, but there's a reason for church and state. There's a reason for the separation, and religious beliefs, I believe, should be talked about in the home and should be talked about within your church, in your ministry. It has no place in public school because there's such a variance of people in this country and so many different kinds of religion. And and frankly, there's no evidence, there's nothing to show that, you know, except our faith, there's nothing to show that God or Christ created the world in 7 days or whatever. But there's so much science behind this Darwinian theory. And I'm just thinking to myself, what is going on here? We're 2004 and we're still battling this? Church and state, we just need a separation.
Mm-hmm. Laura Williams, I wonder if you have a reply to that.
Well, to me, I don't see it as a religious issue, really. I see it more as a family value issue and what parents individually would like to teach their own kids. And for us, for one to, you know, in our particular district, that is important to us is a value that we would like to uphold. And it's not necessarily a religious, you know, Judeo-Christian value. I mean, it's more of a family value type thing where we would say, hey, you know, there's only certain things that the school should be teaching, and then everything else should be left to the parent. So it's, I don't really see it necessarily as a religious issue, as a value issue.
Do you understand those, like our caller Mary, who does?
I understand, sure, that is a concern of hers, and I am certainly of the same persuasion that kids should be offered different options, of course, but I don't really necessarily see this as worth a religious option. I don't know. It's more of a family value.
And where do those family values come from? The raising in the home, or does it come from, at least in part, from religion?
I mean, I don't necessarily see it as a religious issue. I see it more, like you say, as a family value.
Mary, did
how to say that? I mean, because, you know, I think a lot of our kids who we have a very different. We've got lots of different religions at our school, so I don't necessarily mean, you know. And I've had several parents who are of different religious persuasions that have had the same concern. So.
Okay. Mary, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Laura Williams, thank you for your time today. We know you're busy.
Thank you.
Now, this raggedy teacher, she couldn't even answer, where do these quote-unquote family values come from? She just reverted back to, she can't answer, or, you know, this is a family value issue, and so on and so forth. So, first she's trying to sidetrack the issue concerning the concept of these Judeo-Christian religious-based onslaught that is going on in America, and that is a part of the foundation of, in this country, in this context, a white nationalistic supremacist attack at isolating, diverting certain privileges. Hebrons do it, you know, within their context under the Jewish construct in, Israel, Palestine. The Islams do it and, you know, and have been doing it, you know, since the, Arabic slave trade that decimated large portions of Africa and got it going, Syria style in, Mauritania and in the Sudan right now and, on and on. But, she sidesteps it from addressing, it as it, really is and just puts on this Orwellian code word, family values, you know. This is just rhetoric. And, as the caller rightfully said, you know, we're in the year 2004 and we're still battling this. What she was talking about and what she was questioning was evolution versus creationism. And what the caller, I mean, what the teacher, Laura Williams, does is instead of addressing it like an educated teacher and an educated human being, the whole concept of evolution versus creationism, she wants to put it into this, it's a personal decision between the family and their family values if they want to address certain things, and thereby the school should only say so much. So in essence, this is coming from, once again, the religious right sectors that are saying, we don't want evolution being taught in school. We'll cloak it within a family values construct, thereby limiting the schools as much as possible from teaching evolutionary science, and then, quote unquote, leave it up to the teacher. Thereby, the masses of students who should be getting a basic groundwork in evolutionary science maintain are pinned down and gumpified down without any or much choice into the matter by a hierarchical structure that has a completely different agenda set forward. See, this is how sick things have gotten. And this is why clowns like Neil Cohen, who allow these fools to babble on as if there's some substance to what they're saying and as if there is some kind of legitimacy to what they're saying, is a little bit beyond sick in many ways, because it's clear what they're doing and why they're doing it. Now also, the reason why I say that, you know, this has been part of a foundation within the American construct of things is because, you know, in often they like to go into this thing of, you know, King and the civil rights and how that was, you know, in part a Christian-based, you know, movement, you know, and all of that. A lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, one of the few places black people were allowed to congregate without getting lynched, you know, from the slave days on, were the churches. So that became one of the avenues of political socializing and organizing, et cetera, et cetera. Later on, the unions became a stronghold for that, like the Pullman porters and all of that, who helped organize and set up the whole concept of the Montgomery bus boycott. But that's because that wasn't an area to organize. But it's not like the churches became an organizing place because of some kind of higher orders, you know, mystical particular tradition. And it leaves out the historical role that how religions have been used. You know, recently in 1995, the Southern Baptist Convention, their church, congregation of churches, apologized for what? For their church promoting slavery. Now, this whole Southern Baptist Convention was founded in 1845, and its founding was to defend slavery as biblically sanctioned. The birth of the SBC, Southern Baptist Convention, and the Confederacy are linked together. The Southern ministers of the time built antebellum Southern churches and confederacies. Both the North and the South generally supported slavery and white supremacy. But what happened was the Southern ministers described the South as God's country alone, especially when their economic interests began to unfold, as far as in the South they had the slave system going on versus the or at least parts of the North. So the ministers, to protect their hierarchical economic structure of slaveocracy, were saying that the South was a sacred nation, and thereby they cloaked the Civil War as being a quote-unquote holy crusade. In 1860, Debrow Review, this is one of the many newspapers of the South that were cloaked in the hocus-pocus mysticism of the time, and basically helped still frame some of the framework in my mind to, you know, much of the religious rights. They had this to say in 1860, quote, "Many causes will contribute to our happiness as a separate nation, but preeminently in view stands two peculiar features. The one is pure religion, the other is a perfect legal system. In religious sentiments, the South stands as a unit. Its pure doctrines are linked inseparably through, not by legal constraint with the laws of land, but Christ is acknowledged as the common bond of the Union." Now, here, these guys are intentionally, in many ways, like you heard Boy George start off, mixing the justification of the Confederate States within religious terms. They're sanctioned by Christ, that they are the pure set of a religion, or as they call it, a pure religion, in these constructs of the pure state, and basically justify themselves being a separate nation within the cloak. Now, this is the same South that had a ferocious form of black chattel slavery going on. But there was no contradiction in their minds with the concept of chattel slavery and the practice of dehumanized slavery against the Africoid populations of the world, and the mystic teachings of their particular Bibles. As a matter of fact, they used it as a sword of defense for their holy crusade. And as I said before, considered it slavery biblically sanctioned. And went on to call the Civil War, as it sprouted off, a holy crusade. This is not that much different in the way that Boy George and Ashcroft have been cloaking their imperialist wars in the modern context. This is why I've often said that the whole world is being turned into a giant Indian reservation, a globalized hell on planet Earth, because of how these guys use the same tools, the same mechanisms of deceit and destruction and mysticism to hide in the shadows and cloak their particular real intentions of domination of other people's land, other people's resources, other people's labor, other people's identity, other people's humanity, with their own privatized, materialistic, capitalistic goals and profits. We cannot allow these fools of deceit to hide beyond the shadow much longer, because the whole planet is at stake. Hold on a sec.
I think a lot of people would say that one of the reasons that he's very popular is that Mel Gibson's movie has come out, George W. Bush, because of all this.
He wants to see it, and I'm sure that we'll set up a special screening there at the White House.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, he's a devout Christian.
Right.
He prays daily.
Do they think it's about just a movie, just entertainment, or do they think that there's really something bigger at work?
Well, I think they think that there's something bigger at work. September 11th threatened people, and people looked to Jesus for comfort. But number two, a line was drawn around the world between two kinds of religions, two kinds of societies.
Freedom is not this country's gift to the world. Freedom is the Almighty's gift to every man and woman in this world.
Boy, couldn't you just see the elite media tremble over that one? The president knows invoking the deity will anger the secular media. He doesn't care. Talking points employed.
They're going to push God very, very hard. This is going up into Bush's re-election.
All of us working together can change America one soul at a time.
The Christian fundamentalist movement is one that believes in we're right, you're wrong, no matter what. And I saw a lot of that at Fox. We're right, you're wrong, no matter what.
All right, you know what time it is. A few notes from a Draptomania. You know, a little while ago, at the Olympics, it had one of the particular races that was going on, sprinting races, in the women's track. It was the 100-meter heat. It was some of the prelims. It wasn't the finals, but it had in one of the stories, A Run for History, it had sprinter Rakita Al Gasara of Bahrain one of the few women from the Persian Gulf region to compete in the Olympics. And it has her running the 100-meter race. And what's fascinating about this particular episode is if you saw the race or seen the picture of Rika Al-Gassara, she's a Muslim woman, and instead of just having the normal, you know, little track outfit that the men and women have, in her case, she has on the full hijab and, you know, long sleeves and, you know, sprinting pants on, so as not to show, you know, any real flesh and stuff. And I've showed people this picture before, Islams and others, and said, do you see anything obscene in this picture as she's running by this sister, Marine Ati, in the particular prelim race? And 100% of the time, the Islams have said, nah, you know, there's nothing wrong with her, you know, having on the hijab and so on and so forth, and, you know, covering herself. She's a Muslim, and on and on and on. And, you know, I always have to stop them before they get too far going, because that's not what I'm talking about, even though that's what they're looking at over and over again. Even though right plastered right on her, her chest is the corporate Nazi symbol, the corporate swastika, the Nike logo. What's happening in Iraq now is connected to the Nikeification of America, the privatization of other people's resources for the domination of a ruling elite privatized corporate structure, the whole McDonaldization of the planet. So once again, as I said many times before, it doesn't make a difference on a certain sense to me if you're, you know, some Islam, Christian, Hebron. That won't necessarily determine, it hasn't so far, whether I put a bullet in your head. It has in certain cases, but that's another story. What I'm getting at is that you have a situation where many of these people I've come across who are anti-imperialist and so on and so forth, as long as this sprinter, the sister, is covered correctly, that's all they can see. But the fact that she's just another billboard for Nike that is going around the planet pulverizing people, and women in particular, in their little sweatshop death camps, and that whole Nike logo symbolizes what the hell is going on in Fallujah. What's going? I mean, this is, you know, it might as well have been a Texaco or Halliburton logo that she had on. It's the same thing. But if you're trapped in some kind of hocus pocus soap mysticism, you know, as long as someone's dressed the right way, speaks the right way, then you'll never get beyond the shadow and never realize who and what your true enemies are. Just a few notes from a Draptomania. Hold on a sec. Well, that's just going to about wrap it up for Slave tonight. It's clear that as long as we hide within the smoke of various mystic traditions, we will find ourselves choking ourselves out of existence. So instead of dedicating these movements and analysis and liberation struggles in one's own blood, sweat, and tears, to some invisible man in sky, which basically has you bowing down to the rulers within those particular societies. Let's dedicate this, as the brother right here is about to explain, to an organization, the Black Panther Party, that had, at least in its earliest stages, the true interests of the masses of people at heart. Until the next time, slave revolt. Out. I'm gonna go.